Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Exxon Corporation and others versus Chick Cam Chu and others from Harris County. And George F. Speer and the Texas Commission on Human Rights versus Presbyterian Children's Home and Service Agency from Dallas County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of our court. These arguments are being audio recorded for the convenience of the court. If you would like to listen to the tape of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioners in Exxon versus Chick Cam Chu.
May it please the court. Mr. Patrick Cooney will present argument for petitioner. He reserves 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Patrick Cooney. I represent Exxon Corporation, SO Tankers, the petitioners in this case. This case raises the issue of whether the Maritime Forum Nonconvenience Rule preempts Section 71031 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. To at least that extent, it provides this court with an opportunity to reconsider and clarify its holding in Dow Chemical versus Alfaro.
What's there to clarify?
I think there's a question of whether there's preemption or not, and to the extent the limit of that decision. I think that if the court so chooses, if it has to reach the issue, I think that the way the court below decided this issue, relying on Alfaro, that it to some extent opens that case up for consideration, particularly in light of the allegations that somehow this case along the way ceased to be a maritime case, which I will discuss below, Your Honor.
Did you make any complaint concerning the Alfaro decision in the trial court?
No, Your Honor. This was brought up primarily as a preemption case.
So your feeling from the beginning was that this was a case that could be resolved without ever reaching the Alfaro question?
That's correct.
Have you changed that position?
I don't think that it's necessary for the court to reach the Alfaro decision in considering this case. I think given what the 14th Court of Appeals did, and the language is a little bit confusing, I think that they tended to open up the question to some extent. But I have to state that I do not believe that it's necessary in dealing with this case to reach Alfaro. It raises obviously a question of this to the extent of Alfaro and its application in a maritime case brought before the courts of this state. I would like to just very briefly mention.
Counsel, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
This is the same question for both sides. Why doesn't this case fall under federal maritime jurisdiction?
It does fall under federal maritime jurisdiction. This has been a maritime case from the very beginning. In fact, only the very latest stages. This case has been going on for 14 years. And only since the issue of the possibility that 71031 could be preempted has the issue of whether this was a maritime case or not has been raised. The case was filed in federal court first in 1978 as a Jones Act death on the high seas general maritime case, clearly a maritime case by the respondents here. An identical petition was filed in the 270th court below. That petition has not been amended or withdrawn or replaced. So I think that it's literally a situation here of the respondents wanting to have it two ways. Now suddenly when it looks like there's a serious preemption question, it's not a maritime case. But let me go to the merits of why it is a maritime case. And I think you can start with the court's recent decision in Texaco versus Tron. Whether a case is a maritime case or not is a question of jurisdiction, not choice of law. This incident clearly happened on a ship that was afloat with a crew on it in the harbor in Singapore. If it happened in the port of Houston or Galveston, it would clearly be a maritime case. No question about it. I don't think there's any question here. Not only that, we have law of the case before us, all the way up through the federal courts. And bear in mind, this case has been extensively litigated and has been to the United States Supreme Court once, and in a sense is back here, back to the state courts, with direction from the Supreme Court, if you will. It was recognized that this was a maritime case. That's significant in that the only ground, real ground of jurisdiction for the Federals in this case after the second, after the attempt to remove this case, was federal maritime jurisdiction. And a federal court, sui sponte, on its own motion, is not only permitted but obliged to raise questions of jurisdiction, and it was not done so. So I submit that the holdings below by the federal courts implicitly are findings that this is a maritime case. It's been decided it's res judicata. Being that this is a case that is controlled by federal maritime law. I think that's the holding of Tron and its law that goes back to the beginning of the Republic. The real question is how forum nonconvenience fits into the overall maritime law scheme. The Fifth Circuit has held, in a number of cases, fairly recent cases, that forum nonconvenience is a characteristic feature of the maritime law. I'd like to take
the air crash call. Excuse At least me. Doesn't the Delta case call different treatment?
No, sir, I don't believe so. Delta, it's not Delta air crash, it's Inter air crash, New Orleans air crash. Something of an interesting decision where the court reached out in a footnote and said, oh, by the way, we're overruling a bunch of maritime cases. If the court will look at that decision.
It's 18 cases.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And what was going on is in the Jones Act general maritime law area, the Fifth Circuit and a number of other circuits were following the procedure or process of looking first at the threshold question of whose law controlled. If American law was found to control, they simply didn't go to forum nonconvenience. It was a threshold question. The Reno case called that into question, and there was some concern in the bar and attempts, in fact, in previous maritime cases to raise that issue. At any rate, in NRA air crash, the Fifth Circuit chose to do so. If you look at the opinion, all that it says is the court felt that it needed to get the approach, the analysis used in maritime cases in consonance with other forum other general federal forum nonconvenience rule. It did not do away with maritime forum nonconvenience, as is very clear by subsequent developments in the Fifth Circuit and elsewhere, where, if anything, the Fifth Circuit has become even stronger that there is a maritime doctrine that is rather unique, at least in its application of the law, even though the analysis would be the same. Forum nonconvenience has been an inherent part of this country's maritime law from almost the beginning. And I don't think there's any question about that. All the cases, Gilbert recognized that. I think it's useful to explore why, because it is instructive to this court as to why a state court hearing a maritime case under the Savings to Suitors Clause is required to follow the federal forum nonconvenience matter. Federal maritime jurisdiction has, by its nature, always been plenary. That is, if you can find a defendant within the jurisdiction, and in this instance, if you can find a ship or property, a quasi in rem procedure, where if you've got $3 in a bank in a jurisdiction, you're present long before the states began to enact long-arm statutes. The defendants whose presence were in question were most of the time frequently foreigners, or at least non-residents to the jurisdiction, which raised another difficult issue. Maritime law is, by its nature, international law. We're dealing with the adjudication, most frequently, of disputes that involve interests both in the United States and outside of the United States. This case is such a case, but it's the typical problem that the maritime courts deal with. Now, one of the concerns from the very beginning is that a proper harmony and uniformity be established in the maritime law in its international and interstate relations. Maritime courts really had two devices to take care of that problem. One was choice of law, and there's a long line of cases, the ones that we would refer to here because they apply are Lauritzen, Roditis, and Romero. Taking into consideration the pulls and tugs of the various national, international interests in deciding whose law applies to a maritime personal injury case. That didn't allow the court to say, we're not an appropriate forum to decide this particular dispute once the appropriate law was determined. And that's where forum nonconvenience comes in. Maritime courts were exercising their rights to decline jurisdiction when they had it, subject to appropriate conditions, always protecting the parties before them, long before people started calling forum nonconvenience, that need continues. Forum nonconvenience is a fundamental characteristic of the maritime law. It's absolutely necessary to maintain the uniformity.
Just in reviewing the various federal non-convenience, forum non-convenience cases, it looks like there are eight or so factors that the trial court is afforded fairly broad discretion in applying.
Yes, sir.
And given the broad discretion in looking at those eight factors that is part of the trial court, how does applying federal forum non-convenience law assure any uniformity?
It does it on several levels. First of all, there's the analysis and the approach itself. If you look at the Quintero case recently decided by the Fifth Circuit relying on In Re Air Crash, in turn relying on Reno, it sets out a very, very detailed process the trial court has to go through. Now, admittedly, the results can be different, and certainly would be different in different cases, can be different before different judges depending on what value they place on the various factors. But in a situation where you have foreign factors in a maritime case, the litigants are entitled, the defendant is entitled for that process to take place, for that analysis to occur. That is the uniformity I believe that we are concerned about. I would suggest that if you read the cases further and how they've been applied, that the discretion is less than totally unfettered. It is abuse of discretion, but it is clear under Reno that after this analysis has been made, and the analysis is fairly tight, tells exactly what you've got to look at, then the Court of Appeals is to determine, the appellate court reviewing, whoever, whether the conclusions reached by the trial court are reasonable. And I suggest that that creates something less than just a wide open abuse of discretion standard. But the uniformity that is required is that a court consider at some point in a case charged with international concerns whether it is an appropriate court. And what has happened in this area, I know there's much talk about convenience. I would suggest to the court, if you look at the dictionary and look back to the Latin roots of the word, the concern is more appropriateness than convenience. 34 years ago, these kind of cases didn't happen. 50 years ago, they were unheard of because they just simply couldn't. There was no technology to allow them to happen. We're not here talking about whether it's easy or hard to handle one of these cases in a court anywhere in the country. It is easier now than it was, and it can be done. The question that the federal courts in applying maritime law have done, I would suggest to you, is focus primarily on public interest considerations. Are those private interest considerations that bear or have more closely relied on come to public interest concerns? There's a huge problem of availability of witnesses. We're seeing around the world statutes being passed that make it very difficult to conduct American-style discovery by way of an American court. But there are things, in this case, for instance, most cases today are multi-party cases. You very seldom have one single actor involved. In this case, we have a shipyard in Singapore. We have co-workers and subcontractors. We have a superintendent from Exxon International who was, by his own affidavit, which is before the court, not around. We have an indemnity agreement. We have common law indemnity under Singapore law. And one of the factors is not everybody can be here. And that's a concern. And then simply the appropriateness of a court in the United States hearing this case or another case like it, or even to a greater extreme, that really should properly be in a form that is more natural to it. Here we have, this is not El Faro where somebody sent some chemicals out of the country. Here is an Italian crew member in a machine shop who may or may not have dropped a spindle. Spindle falls on the floor. Someone left an access hole open, and we don't even know who that was. It could have been any number of people, and it fell 3 decks and hit a man on top of the head who was wearing a hard hat, apparently. Question, who made the hard hat? And he died. He was either Singaporean or Malaysian. The contract was entered into in Singapore. We went through, we being all of the parties in this case, went through a proceedings where a coroner's inquest was held, a police investigation, all of this sort of thing. This is sort of like, if you will, a traffic accident down on the corner, down from the offices of the High Court of Singapore. And because somebody from Texas or someone who works for a company who is in Texas, the case is now before the 270th court down in Houston to determine how Singapore traffic laws would solve this problem and how we ought to compensate the Singapore citizens who were injured or hurt or killed in the accident.
This is a case brought under Singapore law, and rights and remedies are to be governed by Singapore law. Is that correct?
That is correct, and I think it's worth telling how we got there.
Before you do that,
yes, sir.
Does that leave the difference between this forum and Singapore, the obvious differences in geography, and the pretrial discovery procedures available in the different jurisdictions?
Well, I think the pretrial discovery procedures are obviously different. Singapore follows British law and British procedure. This case would be governed by essentially Lord Campbell's Act, which has been slightly amended by the English and followed by Singapore. Yes, they do not have pretrial discovery in the sense we have in terms of discovery. They have extensive document production. They obviously get witnesses to court. We all watch Rumpole of the Bailey, and they seem to work fairly well over there in terms of the court system.
Aside from the public interest that you have alluded to, are those the principal considerations as they affect the parties in the case?
Well, I think I handle a lot of these cases, and so it's not just Exxon, large U.S. oil corporation that I think of here. I think that there's something more fundamental than pretrial discovery and that sort of thing. I think it gets to both the interest of the litigants, particularly the defendant, in that their reasonable expectations in their international dealings, and then the reasonable expectations of the other forum. In this case, for instance, Exxon enters into a contract to have a vessel repaired in Singapore. This vessel, by the way, is built in Germany, flagged in Liberia, is a very large crude carrier, and I think it's in the record that it has never been to a continental U.S. port for the simple reason, which is not in the record, but it's too big to get into a U.S. port. It just simply could not come here. They enter into this contract in Singapore with a shipyard that's large enough to build the ship, knowing that they're going to have local labor coming on board. And their expectation is that their responsibilities to that labor, I'm just trying to evade anything, their responsibilities are controlled by Singapore law.
And that's true now, though.
That's
this
true.
Case is being brought under Singapore
well,
law.
Well, understand.
The rights and remedies are
that's correct. That's
Singapore
correct.
Law.
And that.
So what is the difference, except for geography, which is appreciable, and the pretrial and discovery procedures that would apply in the two cases?
Well, again, are you said excluding the public factor?
Excluding the public factor.
Well, I think that the difficulties in obtaining witnesses by process, and perhaps most important here from Exxon's point of view, is that it finds itself alone in what ought to be a multi-party situation. It, in its contract, had indemnity rights. It has indemnity rights against the Singapore shipyard. They are beyond the pale. They cannot be brought into a Texas court.
Counsel, is the right of trial by jury implicated here in any way?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It's clearly here, and that's I think part
there
of
not be a,
there would not be a jury over there.
Under Singapore law.
Under Singapore law. Under British procedure, as I understand it, you only get a jury civil side for libel and slander. So they would not be a jury in Singapore. Therein is a difference. But I think that in terms of...
Would there be a jury here in Harris County?
We have a jury here in Harris County.
Would there be a jury?
Yes, sir.
Not in this case?
In this case, there would be a jury in Harris County.
Even though it's part of Singapore law?
Under Singapore law, that's right. Because I think that a jury is, both on federal and state, it is what is under the Savings to Suitors Clause. Frankly, I think it's saved, that's what saved the suitors, is a jury trial. And under the federal, on the federal side, I don't think there would be a right to a trial by jury, because I don't think there is an independent cause of action other than maritime, and this is no longer a Jones Act case.
Is the right to trial by jury such a type of procedure?
I think it's probably procedural, but it's one of those, I think anytime you get into substance and procedure, I think we get into a morass. It is something we, in the United States, obviously hold very dear, and we've got a constitutional amendment on the federal side, and certainly on the state side, we've got constitutional consideration.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
If I heard you correctly a moment ago, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you stated that one of Exxon's greatest grievances with this particular forum is that it stands alone, that the other involved parties, entities, are not amenable to process or not amenable to the court's jurisdiction here. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That is the situation be in Singapore under British law, under Singapore law, would they be amenable there?
Yes, sir. They certainly would, because they were local. This case is local to Singapore. The actors are there. Simbawang Shipyard is there. It provided, you know, its place of business is the Port of Singapore. So they're there, and I think we have to go back to what happened in 1980. Again, the baggage this case carries.
I'm sorry. I believe the court is familiar with the history of this case from the briefs.
Your Honor, have I answered your question?
Let me just do one follow-up to that. In the event that there is any determination that Exxon had responsibility here, is there anything to preclude your proceeding in a court there against whichever party you think is the one that is responsible?
Your Honor, in 1980, there certainly wasn't. I cannot answer that now, but clearly there is a right of action, or would have been a right of action available to us in Singapore after the fact. But again, this is part of the, if you will, the inconvenience, the difficulty that such a situation creates, in that we have to split this case apart. So Exxon, who may have minuscule responsibility, then has got to go to Singapore.
You're saying that Exxon could have initiated action in Singapore in 1980?
No, sir. Not unless the plaintiff had brought action there. As I understand, an indemnity action, it doesn't mature until you've at least been sued. So we had no action against Singapore arising out of this man's death. Had the lawsuit been filed in Singapore as the federal court in 1980 indicated that it should, all of this would have been resolved and Simbawang could have been involved in it.
Could Exxon, subsequent to this litigation, institute proceedings against the other parties in Singapore as a result of this action?
I'm not a Singapore lawyer. I know that in a timely fashion, that can be done. I have been involved in other cases.
The question obviously is, are they being denied whatever remedies might be available to them over there?
I'm concerned at this point, given the passage of time and the fact that in 1980, when the federal court said go to Singapore, it didn't happen, that Exxon may very well be precluded if an adverse judgment is rendered in Houston.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. John O'Quinn will present argument for respondent.
Mr. O'Quinn, in your argument, you also addressed the same question which I asked the opposing counsel, and that is, why isn't this case controlled by federal maritime law?
I will, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Thanks for reminding me of that. Thinking about this case last night and this morning, I'm frankly a little bewildered. This case reminds me of Alice in Wonderland. There's a character in Alice in Wonderland, I think the character is Humpty Dumpty, who says a word means what I want it to mean, when I want it to mean, and how I want it to mean. When you boil all the legalisms down in this case, it's a simple case between Exxon and a lady named Mrs. Chu. And Exxon comes before this court and tells this court it is inconvenient for Exxon to litigate this lady's claim in Houston, Texas.
They say now that inconvenient means inappropriate, or should be inappropriate.
How many times, Your Honor, has Exxon filed pleas of privilege and motions to transfer in Amarillo, Beaumont, Austin, Eagle Pass, or wherever, saying, please, please, please send this case back to Houston, where we have our worldwide headquarters, because that's where it's convenient for us to live. They have their own office building there. Justice Cook, you've probably driven by it hundreds of thousands of times. Have over 150 lawyers in that building, one of the biggest law firms in the world. But yet, it's inconvenient. As far as your question, Justice Heck, case litigated in Houston, American discovery will apply. It's done all the time. I've litigated a number of these cases. Litigated one in Justice Phillips' court, and he was a trial judge. Page against Offshore Technologies, a man that was a diver, hurt the North Sea. There'll be equal discovery on both sides. It's not a one-sided contest. Exxon has participated in literally thousands of lawsuits, according to the district clerk's office in Harris County. Thousands of them. Hundreds of them, they file themselves.
Well, with all due respect, we're a number of years down the road in this case, and we have a number of questions to focus on in this court, starting off with Justice Cook's question. Is this a federal maritime
case? Why doesn't this fall within the federal maritime law? Reason number one. The United States Supreme Court, 1988, this very case, Chu against Exxon, wrote as follows. In 1980, this party, through these lawyers, went to a federal court and got a federal court to rule, sustain a summary judgment, that Singapore law, not the maritime law of the United States, applies in this case. These are the words of the United States Supreme Court reviewing the historical record in this case. These parties, using their lawyers, got a court to rule. Page 1689. No, pardon. 1688. That the statutory and maritime law of the United States should not be applied. Those are quotes from the order of the district court, quoted by the United States Supreme Court on page 1688 of its opinion.
The Supreme Court said the trial judge was wrong.
No, they didn't, Your Honor. Here's what the Supreme Court of the United States said.
Could you give us the U.S. page number?
Yes, sir. Well, let me try to help you.
A defect in our library.
I know.
We don't have
I like to use West because it's got the nice head notes in it. But I believe I never can find these pages, I'm sorry.
Why don't you just mail it in to us?
I'll mail it in. On page of the U.S., of the West Supreme Court reporter, on page 1690, here's what the United States Supreme Court said about this case. Petitioner asserts a claim under Singapore law. You have to understand the procedural posture at this point is after U.S. federal courts, both in the district court and on appeal, the circuit ruled this is not a maritime case. And your claims, if any, are under Singapore law. Mrs. Chu obeyed them. She went to state court and using the Open Courts Act filed her claim under Singapore law, whereupon the defendants sought to enjoin her in federal court from doing that. And the federal court enjoined her. The United States Supreme Court reversed the injunction and held that Mrs. Chu had an absolute right, insofar as the United States Supreme Court was concerned, to do exactly what she did, which is file her claim in Houston, Texas.
Excuse me, counsel, if I'm hearing you correctly, the United States Supreme Court, first a lower federal court, and ultimately the United States Supreme Court in resolving the question of which law applied, says that federal maritime and federal law do not apply to this case. Federal district court so ruled, it was upheld on appeal. They said explicitly that Singapore law applied. The party sued in the state court under Singapore law to open courts provisions. They went to federal court, got that enjoined. That went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court says you can't have it both ways, Exxon. Either federal maritime law applies or Singapore law applies. You got the court to rule that Singapore law applied. Now they're pursuing it under open courts provision in Texas, and what this really is not an assault on that. What it is, this really is assault on Alfaro, isn't it? An assault on the poor non-convenience presence here?
In my judgment, you have correctly summarized the history of this case, the present posture of this case, and what's really involved in this case. I agree with you, Tom. Because the Supreme Court of the United States said on page 1690 that the present claim, which ultimately, because of the reversal injunction, it allowed us to go forward, and that's how we ended up here, is a claim under Singapore law. Listen to what the Supreme Court of the United States says. Quote, federal foreign non-convenience principles simply cannot determine whether Texas courts, which operate under a broad open courts mandate, would consider themselves an appropriate forum for petitioners' lawsuits. Cannot determine. This is the highest court in the land.
So your position is that this case before us is determined favorably to you by what we refer to briefs as Chu 3.
Correct. Let me be fully accurate with you, Judge Hedden. On the federal question, it's res judicata, it's law of the case, and it's even judicial estoppel because it was done at their request. How can they jump around from court system to court system?
And if we disagree with that, then would your position then fail in this case?
No. But if we disagree with that, we still have to answer the question of does federal law preempt a Texas rule of procedure, namely the Open Courts Act, which is an issue I'm going to get to. But to keep my argument in logical progression, I'd like to address another way in which...
I'm confused, counsel.
Yes.
The federal law does not apply.
May I, Your Honor?
Where is the preemption question? Your opposing counsel has already conceded very explicitly that forum nonconvenience does not have to be reached to decide this case. You're arguing that all the other issues have been resolved. Now you say you bring up the question of whether federal law preempts the Texas open courts provision. I'm confused.
Let me try to sort it out for us. Let me sort it out for you, Your Honor, by reading page 1, a sentence from page 1 on the opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case, the very opinion that's under examination by this court. Quote. This is, of course, we're in the Court of Appeals. The widow and children of Leon Chong appeal from an order dismissing their claims on the basis of federal forum non-convenience. So what Judge Cochran did in his inner order, in fact, she went to the trouble, this is a Xerox copy, it's in the transcript in the court, to handwrite in her order exactly what she was doing. And the Court of Appeals has correctly interpreted and read her handwritten language, as you will see. So, now to put everything in context, the U.S. Supreme Court said first, federal principles cannot determine this case for two reasons. Because we've already decided by district court litigation affirmed on appeal that federal law doesn't apply, reason number one. Reason number two that federal principles cannot apply is because the matter of forum non convened or not is a matter of court administration, is a matter of court procedure, and as we ourselves held in the state of Missouri against Mayfield, cited extensively in everyone's brief in this cause, state law, not federal law, governs an action filed in state court, even if the action is predicated upon federal law, that being an FBLA case in that situation. So what the U.S. Supreme Court said and what the U.S. Supreme Court ordered, instructed Exxon to do, was to go to state court and find out if whether under state law this matter should be dismissed under forum non convenience.
But under federal forum non convenience.
No, sir. Under state.
Are you correct?
The U.S. Supreme Court says it may be that Exxon's reading of the preemptive force of federal maritime forum nonconvenience determinations is correct. This is a question we need not reach, and we simply hold that Exxon must present its preemption argument to the Texas state courts, which are presumed competent to resolve federal issues. Now, what could that mean other than that Judge Cochran was supposed to do what she did, and that is consider whether or not the federal federal maritime forum nonconvenience should be applied in this case, and if so, apply the Ritson factors?
That is a very interesting question, which I have thought about, and let me give you my answer. We cannot take that one sentence out of context in a 10-page or 15-page opinion. When you turn back the prior page, the Supreme Court clearly said this. The federal principles cannot determine. It's a pretty strong word, cannot. Cannot determine whether the Texas courts will consider themselves an appropriate forum. Granted, Your Honor, now you turn to page, you're on page 1691 of the Supreme Court of the West publication. It may be that respondents' reading of the preemptive force of the federal determination is the federal court's determination of forum not convened in this specific case, somehow under some concept of law of the case otherwise, going to tie the hands of the state court. That's the only way you can make sense, I submit, Your Honor, of the earlier statement where the Supreme Court says that the principles, not determination, the principles of federal forum not convened cannot determine what the state courts will and will not do. And the Supreme Court, Your Honor, had to say that unless they wanted to overrule their decision in state of Missouri against Mayfield, an FELA case, which is a federal law case governed by all these reverse Erie concepts that the states are not free to expand or contract upon the rights of the injured employee. And by the way, the Jones Act is bottomed on FELA. When you read the history of the Jones Act and the FELA, and the Supreme Court's opinions concerning the history, you will learn again and again, FBLA was first, and the Jones Act was modeled after, bottomed on, and to be construed in accordance with case law construing the FBLA. So I submit to Justice Phillips, that is the way to put together and make sense out of these two disparate sentences.
All right,
even if I be wrong, that what we were really to do was to grapple with the subject of whether federal forum non-convenience principles must always be followed by a state court in a maritime case. They've got a big problem with their position. Number one, this is not a maritime case. Not only is it not a maritime case because it's been so decided in this very case in federal court, which, my God, ought to mean something. Isn't it law of the case or something?
Mr. Quinn, what about the question of your pleading? Did your pleadings make it a federal case? You pled it under the Jones Act?
Your Honor, my pleadings are in the alternative. He is incorrect when he tells you my pleadings in state court are identical to my pleadings in federal courts. Because my pleadings in state court pled as a separate count that I wanted my relief due me under Singapore law and under the Open Courts Act. Alternatively, I would want whatever relief I was entitled to under maritime law. But it wasn't bottomed just that way. Their position is that I have no more right to seek relief under maritime law because res judicata. So be it. Issue not before us. Issue not presented to Judge Cochran. Issue not ruled upon by Judge Cochran, who said very plainly in her own handwriting, the only thing I'm deciding for you folks today, by the way, it's a summary judgment proceeding. Summary judgment. Under our practice, summary judgment is limited to the exact issues presented and ruled upon. We can't sprawl around here and dream up new reasons to support a summary judgment that were not presented to, ruled upon by the judge. She said, the only thing I'm going to decide for you, federal forum non-convenience law preempts the state law. That's all she decided. Now, I've already argued that wasn't the right thing to be presented to her, and I made my argument. But let's assume for sake of discussion that was the right thing to present to her. The further reason this is not a maritime case is what was presented to her. She was presented the affidavit, their affidavit. This is in the transcript that the court has of a fellow named Robert Berner. And what did Mr. Berner say in his affidavit? Mr. Berner said, we had a contract with the Singapore shipyards to dry dock and repair this vessel. To dry dock it and repair it. We took the vessel in there on March the 3rd and they started fixing it. This man that got hurt was not a member of the crew. He didn't even work for the ship. Like taking your car to the garage, he was a mechanic fixing the ship. 3 weeks later, the ship's still in there being fixed. In fact, one of the federal opinions said they were, quote, extensive repairs. The ship's turbine, boiler engines, generators, etc. were shut down. The vessel was connected to shore services supplied by Simbawang, which is like, they're like the repair shop. They're your mechanics, including using their electrical power. The vessel was not capable of navigating on its own power. This is their affidavit. This is their summary judgment. Their summary judgment evidence in front of the judge.
Do you have any controverting affidavits, or should we take this
no,
as true?
No, I was happy with that.
For summary judgment purposes, these are the facts.
Right. I was delighted. Made my point. Let's say that we say, okay, we don't care about all the affidavits say this is not a maritime case. We don't care that the district courts and the courts of appeal and the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court have all said this is not a maritime case. We don't care about that. We're going to say it is. Just so we can go to their argument, which is, was Judge Cochran correct or was Judge Cochran incorrect in saying that federal law preempts state law? All of the authority that is controlled says no. What is that authority? The U.S. Supreme Court in 1950 in the state of Missouri versus Mayfield, which I've discussed, in which the U.S. Supreme Court told the Supreme Court of Missouri that if the Supreme Court of Missouri dismissed this case because it felt under compulsion of federal law to do so, it should be relieved of that compulsion. It is free to determine the availability of the principle of forum non conveniens in those suits according to its own local law.
How do you distinguish distinguish the Akos Pintakis case out of the Fifth Circuit in 1990 that held that Louisiana's failure to recognize foreign nonconvenience was preempted by federal maritime law.
It's wrong.
That's one way to distinguish it.
I'm not going to play with you, Judge. I'm not going to try to fish around. It's dicta, true enough. It's a Fifth Circuit opinion, not binding on this court. Granted, you should pay attention to it and be persuaded if you want to be persuaded by it. It's wrong. It is. There is a view. Let me deal with this straight up. There's a jealousy here. Who's going to run this show? Are we going to let these states have a little freedom and independence? Whatever happened to states' rights? We've been hollering this country for three decades now that we want states' rights. We want to get the federal government off our back. We want to get government back down to the grassroots where the people are. Alice in Wonderland. Words mean what we mean. The ends justify the means. The federal courts have decided that they have their own agenda, which is they're going to run their maritime show. And that opinion, you read it, you read between the lines, they're saying, we're going to break you. We're going to make you do what we want you to. Now, what did the Louisiana Supreme Court say about it? Sister state. March 1992, Supreme Court of Louisiana. Directly in point. I've attached this brief as an appendix to the supplemental brief I filed yesterday with the court. Just found it.
I gather your position is that Justice White will be wrong in his concurring opinion.
You're speaking of Chu?
Yes, Chu.
Yes, but I think there's a lot of dicta, and you've got to read a lot in it to get to the preemption part. What White talks about is uniformity. Which brings us to the point, whether uniformity compels preemption. I don't know where the trains got off the tracks about preemption, but when I went to law school, which hopefully wasn't that long ago, was it that long ago, Justice Gonzalez? Preemption was something not lightly done to the states. The court said implied preemption is not something done lightly. If the preemption is not expressed, we're not going to rule unless it's compelled. What congressional statute has adopted forum nonconvenience? None. What is being used to preempt Texas? A congressional statute? No. There is none. Forum nonconvenience is practiced and used by the federal courts is simply a rule of court administration. Read their opinions. Starting with Gulf Oil Corporation versus Gilbert, the 1947 opinion by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is cited in our papers, which explained the rationale for forum nonconvenience as to be utilized by the federal courts. It is simply a rule of court management, of comity, of court administration. There is jurisdiction. It's simply the court chooses to exercise its discretion not to use the jurisdiction it has.
In other words, it would have no binding force and effect on any state as far as the issue is concerned because it's simply a federal administrative rule. It's not
correct.
Even federal common law, which is said not to exist.
Correct. So let's make no mistake about it. What they are saying is they want a court of a rule of administration adopted by federal judges, never endorsed by Congress. You know, at least our rules of procedure have to be approved by the legislature indirectly. This wasn't even in a rule of procedure where Congress would have it laying on its desk to say we don't like it. And that preempts the right of the state of Texas to have its own laws? That can't be so. That can't be so.
Are there any other questions?
What was the Louisiana case that you...
Your Honor, the Louisiana case, Miller against American Dredging Company in 595 Southern 2nd 615, and it directly holds that even though that was a maritime case, even though in that case the plaintiff was suing under the Jones Act and the maritime law and only under the maritime law, the Louisiana Supreme Court held that forum non-convenience being procedural, the states having the right to use their own procedures in a reverse Erie case, that Louisiana was entitled to use its own forum rules to decide a maritime case.
We have
I hope I answered your question earlier, Justice Cook, or at least gave you the best answer I could.
Thank you, Counsel.
Well, yes. One last question. So you're saying under a FAO there is no forum non-convenience doctrine in Texas, and we've got to leave it alone?
You bet. Particularly if the court meant what it meant in the Robson case side in our papers, that once the legislature has met after you've done it, what are we going to do? Bring the lobbyist in here and let you rewrite it for them? Thank you very much for listening to me.
Counsel, will you respond to Mr. O'Quinn's citation to the Burner affidavit?
Yes, sir.
He said this ship was moored and shut down and not capable of navigating.
And that's absolutely correct. That's what it said, and it goes to what the ship was doing, and it's totally factual.
Doesn't have anything to do with maritime jurisdiction?
No, it doesn't. It has to do what the attempt is being made is to argue that the ship was out of navigation. If you read the rest of the record, you will see the itinerary of this vessel before and after its repairs in Cimbuwang. To maintain certification to trade, vessels periodically have to go in and receive certain repairs and inspections. This was a three-week-plus repair job, which is not unusual. The vessel returned to trading, and simply the fact that it may have been in dry dock for a day or two, which is typical in a three-week repair job, has nothing to do with maritime jurisdiction. The fact is that this happened in a maritime situation, a ship afloat with its crew on board preparing the ship so it could continue to sail.
Counsel, I agree with you that the dry dock is one of those things in the normal course of events that does affect maritime trade and commerce.
Yes.
And it doesn't take it out of the category of maritime law, but apparently, according to what Mr. O'Quinn says, you, through federal judicial processes, have taken it out of maritime law and put it squarely into Singapore law. And you did, if I heard you correctly, concede that forum non-convenience is not a question this case needs to reach.
I think what I said is that
O'Farrell
this case
does not have to be touched.
This case
question
does not
you argue on the one hand that federal forum non-convenience standard must apply, even though Singapore law applies and federal law does not apply. Is indeed federal forum nonconvenience an administrative procedural device, not a rule of law that would have any preemptive effect on the states deciding their own situation as far as forum nonconvenience is concerned?
I believe I detect two questions. I'll try to answer both.
Maybe more than two of them.
The first question I think we have to deal with is, how is Singapore law applicable in this case? And it's applicable by the application of maritime choice of law factors. What you do in a case of this nature, this is the teaching of the United States Supreme Court.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I think in your opening comments you said this is a question of preemption and not of choice of law.
Yes, sir, but you've asked me, Singapore law applies. And I think to answer your question, I have to tell you why Singapore law applies and explain to you why that does not make it to stop being a maritime case, controlled otherwise by American law as long as it's over here. Singapore law, the choice of law determination was made under three cases, Lauritzen, Roditis, and Romero, three U.S. Supreme Court cases, part of our, if you will, common maritime law, common law of admiralty, that goes to the question of what substantive law is going to control the rights of the parties. In other words, is the Death Act of Singapore or DOSHA or the Wrongful Death Act of Texas going to apply? So the courts applied maritime law. As a result of the application of maritime law, it was determined that Singapore law controls. Another example, slightly different, but very recently, the Fifth Circuit, following old precedent in a clear maritime case involving a maritime insurance policy, held, because it came out of Texas, that Texas insurance law will apply. That case did not cease being a maritime case because it will be controlled by the statutes of this state. That's simply that the maritime courts have chosen to adopt state law in insurance situations. The reason that Singapore law applies in this case is because maritime choice of law factors gets you to that result. And in fact, on this whole issue of preemption and whether it has to be statutory or not, one of the interesting things the United States Supreme Court did is it affirmed the injunction on the application of Singapore law. And the only way it could do that was to affirm the application of maritime law to get to that result. One, it wasn't a statutory finding. Those three cases under which the choice of law determination was made are not anywhere in the U.S. Code, number one. Number two, they are maritime cases. So I submit to you that the fact that Singapore law applies really is simply an American court saying in this instance, as a matter of American maritime law, we have to apply
Where did the
Singapore
Supreme
law.
Court do that? Affirming application of Singapore
It did in the concluding part of the decision, Your Honor, where it, and I don't have the page cite, but there's a paragraph that starts something to the effect that the court went too far in its injunction.
I think I see it.
But in fact,
Justice White says, as this court recognized that this case involves a special area of federal maritime law, can you point to a place in the majority opinion where they say that in, with such clarity?
Without note, Your Honor. It's not quite as clear in the majority opinion. I think in the problem in these cases, it was so clear that it was a maritime case. If it wasn't, let me suggest to the court that the Fifth Circuit and the Supreme Court of the United States both engaged in a colossal waste of time, because the issues before them were questions of maritime preemption. What should have happened back in the district court before Judge Norman Black long ago was somebody say, this is not a maritime case, go to state court, and we would have this thing resolved.
How come Singapore law, the fact that Singapore law is applied, if the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes that or force make this a federal maritime case?
Because that's the way the law is. It's rather a result rather than beginning. You get to Singapore law only because maritime choice of law criteria were applied.
But court could choose Singapore law as the most significant.
In this instance, the state court is not free to do that. The Supreme Court has taken that away from the state court, and that as a matter, and has to be as a matter of maritime law, because that's the way that holding was arrived at.
In other words, if the Supreme Court has dictated that it's Singapore law, it would only have the authority to do that because it's federal maritime
Absolutely.
Law.
They essentially
Otherwise,
held,
that would have to be left to the
They held system. That at least the issue of preemption on the law question was so clear a relitigation injunction was appropriate. They did not feel that the forum nonconvenience holding was so clear that preemption was appropriate and directed ultimately this court to consider that preemption issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience.